Hi, this is Leo, and this is my KFI podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, May 14th, 2006, on KFI AM 640 in Los Angeles. This is show 248.
May 14th, 2006.
Right now it is 70 in Fullerton, 66 in Irvine, 66 in Northridge. KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks at 11:06. I'm Ginger Chan, KFI News.
Thank you, Ginger. Good morning, everyone. Happy Mother's Day. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. And it's time to talk about the stuff that's changing our world, high tech. And maybe Mother's Day doesn't seem like the ideal time to talk about high tech, but you know, even moms have to use technology, want to use technology, love technology sometimes. Sometimes they hate it. We can talk about things for your mom and to make life for mom better. Of course, anything with a chip in it is stuff we talk about. Digital cameras, cell phones, PDAs and camcorders, home theater, and of course, yeah, I guess computers and the internet. Why not? We'll talk about that as well. 1-800-520-1KFI is the phone number. 1-800-520-1534 if you'd like to talk. You know, we have a law in California against the sale of violent video games to minors. It bans it, you know, it's not legal. But now a federal judge in San Jose is hearing arguments on whether that's a constitutional law. Seems the video game doesn't like the industry, doesn't like the idea of banning the sales of violent video games to minors. They say that's a violation of their First Amendment rights. The law was written by Leland Yee in San Francisco. Governor Schwarzenegger signed it into law. It wouldn't take effect, or it wasn't to take effect until the beginning of the year, and of course this court battle has delayed that. It bars retailers from selling to minors video games deemed ultra-violent, that is, depicting serious injuries to human beings. So most games, you're battling aliens or creatures, so that eliminates, you know, Doom. It's now Halo. I guess you could say you're shooting humans in Halo. Certainly Battlefield. Ultraviolet is depicting serious injury to human beings in a manner that is especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel. I think part of the problem is, how do you define that? If you're killing Nazis in Battlefield 1942, is that heinous, vicious, or cruel? Probably they wouldn't say so. Probably it's more like against things like Grand Theft Auto. Or Postal. Have you seen that? Was not a big hit. And I think because it was so, that was ultra-violence. That was the kind of thing where, well, I guess you could do this in Grand Theft Auto, too. You'd knock somebody's head off. And in Postal, you'd kick it down the street. And do other, the word heinous leaps to mind. Other things that are absolutely atrocious. Judge Ronald White, who's hearing the case, blocked the law from taking effect. The Video Software Dealers Association and the Entertainment Software Association, two video game industry associations, sued. At that time, the judge said the video game industry has a reasonable chance of winning its case. The case was based on the argument that the law violates, get this, the First Amendment rights of minors. I could say you could say the law violates the First Amendment rights of the video game company. Isn't it their speech? But they argued, no, it's minors. It's the kids whose right to buy these games is being infringed. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I guess that's the best argument because the judge agreed. The judge also asked a very interesting and I think really probably the most important question here. Is there any evidence that violent video games like Grand Theft Auto cause violent behavior? Do they need to be regulated by the state? My guess is that the judge is saying this is a violation of the First Amendment, but if you can show, and courts have ruled this in similar cases in the past, if you can show an overriding concern of the state Well, maybe we'll take that into consideration. It's like shouting fire in a crowded theater. There are some things the First Amendment does not protect. If you could prove that violent video games caused juveniles to become violent, well, I guess we'd want to do something about that. You know, it's interesting. Even the FBI's own statistics on violent crimes committed by youth show that in the last 10 years, it's dropped dramatically. Dropped by more than 50%. In the last 10 years, the 10 years that video games have gotten more and more violent, kids have become less and less violent. Now, I would not tie the two together, but I think you can say, well, if video games caused violence, wouldn't we expect to see some increase in violence, or at least not a drop by 50%? If you've ever read the book Freakonomics, what an interesting book. A maverick economist whose specialty is taking a look at numbers and trying to tease conclusions out of these numbers without falling for false causality and saying, well, this, you know, this must mean that. But actually trying to prove logically and with rigor that it makes sense. And one of the things he looks at is, why is it that violent crime has dropped so dramatically? And there were a lot of theories. You may not remember it, but about 15 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, all the experts were saying, we are on a dramatic upswing of violent crime, particularly juvenile crime. And if it continues, we're going to have to really change the laws. And this is going to be a disaster in this country. And right about the time they started saying that, the crime rate started dropping. And it suddenly became safe to walk the streets in most big cities, not everywhere. But certainly it's better than it was. You look at a city like New York, where in the 80s, you'd be afraid to walk down the streets. And then nowadays, it just feels so much safer. So his question is, well, why? He comes up with a very controversial conclusion. I'm not even sure I want to repeat the conclusion because it's not the point of the conversation today. But he does look at some of the things that people suggest, that the aging demographics, there are fewer juveniles and so forth, and rejects all of them. He actually, his conclusion, which is extremely controversial, and again, I'm not here to espouse it or even to argue for it, and I certainly don't think it's the role of this show to do that, is that legalized abortion is what did it, because the kids that would be most likely to commit violent crimes were aborted once Roe v. Wade became the law of the land. It's an interesting conclusion. I leave it to you to read the book Freakonomics if you want to judge that. But I think the point is, violent video games have clearly not caused a rise in violent crime in youth. On the other hand, now on the other side, the video game industry said that studies, state government officials have cited that appear to show a link between violent behavior and video games are flawed. We're not the first state to do this. Washington State did it. A very famous law. So did Michigan and Illinois. In every case, courts have overturned the laws or blocked them from taking effect. The attorney for the video game industry said the government shouldn't be in the business of deciding for the parent what their kids can play or cannot play. That makes sense. I think if you could make the case that video games cause violent behavior, it would be in the interest of the federal government or the state government or the local government to say, okay, we're going to ban them because it's bad for society. It's causing a problem. We've got an increase in juvenile crime, and we can pretty clearly attribute it to games. But that's not the case. There is no overriding societal need to take these games off the market. And barring that, well, it should be up to parents. So I think this is the right thing to do. But it is a tough decision because these games are horrible. You look at a game like Postal. Oh, man. And my kid, you know, I'll tell you, I let my kid. This is a debate, by the way, that many of us techies who have kids have internally. I've had this debate with John C. Dvorak, who has kids, sons and daughters, who are now teenagers and grown, and he said, I let them play violent games and didn't make them violent. It's fine. Even when they were little, I let them play violent games. And see, to me, now I let my kid play Grand Theft Auto before I knew better, till I saw him. I've told this story before. He came up behind. He said, "Dad, look at this. This is so cool." Now, he's 11. "Look, this is so cool." And in the game, he creeps up behind somebody sitting on a park bench, hits him with a baseball bat, knocks his head off, and the blood is spurting out of the guy's neck. And I was appalled. He said, "Isn't that cool?" I said, "Yeah, that's the last time you're playing that game." I'm not worried that it's going to make him violent, although I think it probably does have a desensitizing effect, just as violence in TV and movies does, and there's certainly a lot of that. By the way, nobody's talking about banning that, are they? Not at all. I guess that lobby is a little too powerful to go against. They thought they could take on the video game industry, maybe, but I think it is up to parents. The problem is that many parents don't think it's a problem. So parents, I'd like to hear, what do you think? Do you want help from the state in keeping these games? We don't sell cigarettes to minors. We don't sell booze to minors. Should we be selling violent video games to minors? Or should the government stay out of censorship? It's certainly, you know, as a parent, it is a difficult thing to do to say, "No, son, you can't play Grand Theft Auto." I get a lot of heat from my kid for that. All the other kids are playing it. Oh, man. And, you know, sometimes he does go over to the other kid's house and they're playing it and he plays it without my knowledge, I'm sure. But in our house, he doesn't play it. He's not allowed to. He's not allowed to play games of any kind like that. You know, I let him get backyard wrestling, which is it's pretty violent. And there's blood spurting, but at least it's wrestling, and it's mano y mano. And he does that anyway. I don't know. It's a tough decision for a parent. And there are a lot of parents would like it so that they didn't have to face that tough decision or didn't have to face their kids. Just said, "Hey, sorry, Henry. If it were up to me, I'd let you play Grand Theft Auto, but Governor Schwarzenegger says you can't." That would be a lot easier. But is it the right thing to do? 1-800-520-1KFI is my phone number. We could talk about that. We could talk about your computer woes, your technical troubles. If you're in the market to buy something, maybe a last-minute digital camera for mom. 1-800-520-1KFI. Let's talk about it. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
It's a four-hour jolt of auditory espresso. Bill Handel, the best cup of joe in town.
KFI, AM 640.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. 1-800-520-1KFI is my phone number. The show notes are online if you'd like to make a comment, a suggestion, answer a question, or ask. Well, ask one's not so great because I don't know if they'll get answered. They might. You just go to the KFI show notes. It's best to ask the question on the air, to be honest with you. KFI show notes are available by going to KFIAM640.com. And click the shows button. You'll see my name, Leo Laporte, there. Click that. And then under my lovely picture, there's a link to my official website. That's what it's called. The official website. I should get them to rename it show notes. You can just go to leo.am if that's a little too complicated for you. leo.am. You also have a chat room. You can participate in it. We'd love you to do it. It's irc.dslextreme.com. And thanks to DSL Extreme for providing the bandwidth for that chat room. About 90 people in there having a great time. Our mods, our Dan, and Mike, and Ash, O-Wine, and Sweeks today. And they're keeping it clean for all the kids who like to go in there. Norman, Los Angeles, welcome to KFI. I'm Leo Laporte. Hi, Norman.
How are you?
Great. Welcome to the show.
Listen, this might sound like a dumb question, but it's right into the area of games. I actually don't go out and buy them because I would be on the computer all day playing them.
Yes.
How does one get the games that come with Windows off of their computer?
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Because in fact, many authors do that because they don't want to be sucked into playing solitaire and Tetris.
Precisely. It's like a lizard's tail. You delete them, and they come back.
They come back. Really? Now, that's interesting, because you are able to add-remove them. In the add-remove programs control panel, there's a Windows add-remove Windows components section.
Oh,
and,
there is? Okay.
Yeah, okay. And so you go in there, and you'll see a variety of different categories, and you want to go into the accessories and utilities category.
Okay.
This is on Windows XP. and you'll see games. You know, you can do the games one by one. Just keep pressing the details button to get more information. So if you want to do, you know, just one or two games, you can get rid of just one or two games. If you want to get rid of all of them, just uncheck the boxes for what you don't want. So you can uncheck all of games. That'll save a whopping 12 megabytes.
Yeah, I took out the game section, but they just keep regenerating.
They keep coming back. Well, that's interesting.
The directory itself, the System32 directory, they just keep regenerating.
Oh, I know why. Yeah, okay. So, that's because Windows has a new feature called self-healing. And you've injured it, you see. And it's healing itself. It's saying, I want my games! It's actually a good thing what XP does is it looks to see if any system files, that is, files that came with the install, have been damaged or deleted and replaces them. But it shouldn't add them back to the start menu, does it?
No, not to the start menu.
But you know they're there, so you,
yes, I know they're
being
there,
the smart monkey that you are,
having no willpower, I go back and find them and then end up half a day of solitaire, which is
I know the feeling. I hate it. It's you know, and I love games, and that's exactly why I can't play. I'm the same way. I had World of Warcraft on my hard drive, and people who listen to my podcast will realize that for about 3 weeks when the podcast didn't get updated, that's because I was playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah, you see, that's what I'm afraid I would do.
Yeah.
That's why I've never bought a video game like that, because I would just be on it.
Let me take a break for news and see if there's a way to... I have a feeling I know of a way, but I'm going to make sure it doesn't break anything to permanently delete those games so that they won't come back, okay?
So it's not as dumb of a question as...
No, it's a good question. You knew how to uninstall them officially, but yes, Windows does restore them, so let's figure out how to keep them off the hard drive. I'm going to do some research and find out for you, okay? Because I want to support your productivity. Leo Laporte and mine. You'd think we'd have enough willpower. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. 11:29, right now it's Ginger Chan in the KFI News Center.
Nighttime is the right time for John Ziegler. Tomorrow night, 7 to 10. KFI, AM 640.
KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, on KFI. A reminder, the Mac Gathering is coming up next weekend. I want to give Deb a big plug because she does a great job. This is a Macintosh Computer Expo for Southern California. If you're a Mac fan, it's going to be at the Beverly Garland Hotel May 19th and 20th. And she is offering free expo tickets for anybody who uses my name, Leo, as the promo code. So go to macgathering.com and you can attend the expo, at least for free. The seminar tickets are extra, although she says she's going to give some seminar tickets as well to folks for randomly. So that's nice. 1-800-520-1KFI is the phone number at 11:38. Let's get back to the phones. Mark in Santa Ana. Welcome to KFI, Mark.
Hey, thanks, Leo.
Sure, thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
I have a quick question. I have want to make a website that takes people, registered voters, and gets opinions based on will they vote out whoever, whatever public official, based on results instead of just what they promise and never deliver.
So you're kind of trying to keep them, hold their feet to the fire, keep them honest, that kind of thing?
Right, right. Because one thing I've noticed is that everybody individually feels rather... you know, they don't feel like they make a difference.
Right.
But a couple of years ago on a radio station, they actually put the feet to the fire of congressmen, and I actually called a congressman and got him to call me back when enough callers of the radio station called him back.
That's great.
And
So you think if you did a website like this, you could kind of organize, in other words, and get people to keep their members of Congress honest. I think that's a great idea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So disenfranchised.
How much do you know about web design? I mean, is this something completely new to you, or you have some background, some expertise?
No, I have some background. I have a ICS degree.
Oh, good.
So
all right.
It's not like I can't. It's not something I do a lot.
So this is a kind of a specialized website because you need to keep a database, basically.
Right.
You need to keep information about... Yeah, the people. Do you want to keep information about the people who come to your site and or just kind of keep a database of what members of Congress are up to so people can go to the site and look at it?
No, what I want is I want only registered voters to get on and just simply put in their name, address, so I can check to see if they're registered, and then just have the biggest hot topics, such as, you know, do you like gas being at three, right, whatever a gallon? Are you tired of illegal immigration? You know, just maybe five or six hot topics. And based on any of these, would you be willing to vote the guy out,
right,
no matter what, just to hold his feet to the fire if things don't get better by election time?
Of course, it's difficult nowadays in today's climate to get people to give you personal information.
Right. But then again, that stuff I found out I can buy, so I'll have it anyway.
Oh, great. you're gonna be one of those, eh? I know you're not going to spam anybody, and I think this is an honorable cause, absolutely.
Right. In fact, that's why I say I can buy it. I want only people who are interested.
You want people to submit it, yeah.
And the only reason I want that information is to prove they are the registered voters, because I want this to be accurate. I don't want the members of the House or the sheriff or whatever to think, he just made this up.
Well, let me address a couple of issues. I mean, the technical issues, I mean, I've already raised the one issue, which is I don't know how you're going to get people to do this, but I'll leave that to you. That's just social engineering. But let me address the technical issues. What you need is a website that has a database on the back end, and that's not uncommon nowadays. My show notes, the KFI website, most websites, Amazon.com, have databases on the back end. They're what's called dynamic websites. You know, we're kind of in the early days of the web, we were used to this idea of websites that looked like brochures. They were static websites. They didn't change much. They certainly didn't have to relate back to a database of products. But that quickly became pretty limited. You see these brochure sites still around, and they seem kind of old-fashioned. Nowadays, we want sites that visitors can enter comments on. They're polls. They want to be able to interact with a database of products or movie listings or whatever. And so many, many websites, I'd venture to say the vast majority of websites now are dynamic. So, for instance, if you go to the KFI, my show notes at leo.am, you'll see, you know, when you click on a link, you'll see a page that's generated just for you because that page is changing all the time. This is a kind of software called a wiki. And it's probably not what you want, although a wiki is really good for collaboration, for people working together. And so when somebody changes the site, the database is updated, and the next person who comes to the site sees those changes. If you go to Amazon.com, the database they connect to, well, it started with products, of course, and that database will change as those products change. But now it includes a lot more. You can have reviews of products, people's lists, their wish lists, their suggestions. There's, you know, and if there's a lot of software running in the background with recommendations and so forth. That's really much more common. And that's certainly what you want. You want a website that people will be able to enter in data, that'll keep track of that data, they'll be able to look it up in the voter records, that will be able to, which is another database, so you'll need some interactivity with another database. You'll need to track things and have things running automatically. For instance, perhaps there's a database somewhere of, and I imagine there is, of votes in Sacramento that you would want to do something called scrape. That's what we call it. It's kind of gleaning information from a website. You scrape the information out of there so you know how those assemblymen are voting, for instance, and then put that information up on your webpage. It's a pretty elaborate thing. So typically, these things can be written in a number of languages. They can be using a number of databases, everything from the high-end Oracle, you know, very expensive databases that big companies use. But I have to tell you, companies like Amazon and Google that have giant, massive databases and lots of traffic use free software like MySQL, which is probably the one you'd want to use. It's absolutely free, open source. They're using a free open source web server called Apache, and very frequently their software is written in something called PHP. In fact, this combination is often called LAMP. The L is for Linux, which is the free and open operating system that it's running on. The A is Apache, the free and open web server. M for MySQL and P for PHP. When you go to the show notes, that's a LAMP site. Those are the software programs that are running. That's what I encourage people to look at. There are, you know, you could go proprietary. You go to with Microsoft IIS, which is their web server, and ASP and Microsoft SQL Server and a lot of expensive commercial applications, and I don't think they'd be any better, to be honest. Now, of course, some of this is determined by your web host, but if I were you, I would look for a web host that supports LAMP, the LAMP architecture. If you're not a programmer yourself, sounds like you might be, But if you're not a programmer yourself, it's the good thing about PHP. It's very easy to find programmers who can write that stuff. You keep the source code, so if they bug out, as they often do, you know, they're often young guys and they move on, you can give it to somebody else and say, hey, I want you to update it and maintain it. I think it's the best way to go. You can even find off-the-shelf software that will do a lot of what you want. For instance, my website for the podcasts, twit.tv, T-W-I-T.tv, is running on a very popular, very good, highly recommended content management system called Drupal, D-R-U-P-A-L. And I use it, and I use it for a lot of my sites because it is so powerful, so flexible, and really great at that kind of thing. In fact, there is a Drupal distribution that is designed for community organization that might even be what you would like. Actually, this might be the way to do it. It's kind of an out-of-the-box, a turnkey system, and it's called, I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's escaping me. If you go to drupal.org, you'll be able to find out more about it. There's also a Drupal hosting company called Bryght, B-R-Y-G-H-T, that I like a lot. They're in Vancouver. They for very inexpensively, will allow you to set up a publishing system based on Drupal, based on all those technologies I just mentioned, easily customized, database access and so forth, can do many of the things, maybe all of the things you want to do. I think you're going to have to do some custom programming because of the data scraping that you want to do, the data mining. But Drupal will allow you to, you know, sign up people, keep track of them, look up their information, make sure they're in the voter database, that kind of thing as well. I think Drupal is probably a good place to start. And Bryght is a good Drupal hosting company. I'll put a link in the show notes to them. There, it's Bryght, B-R-Y-G-H-T. B-R-Y-G-H-T. Thanks for the call, Mark. I appreciate it. 1147, Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
Hate that behind the eight ball Monday morning feeling? Stay in the loop all weekend long. More stimulating weekends.
KFI, AM 640.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI, 1152, 1-800. There's too many numbers in there. It's 1152 in the morning on Mother's Day. The phone number is 1-800-520-1KFI. It's confusing if I just fire numbers at you, especially this early in the morning. 1-800-520-1KFI. You know, I didn't mention, and I probably should, a couple of things about doing your own website. If you really want to get into it yourself, and I'm a do-it-yourself kind of guy. That's one of the things I like about computers is you can do it yourself. If you've got time, the energy, and the brains upstairs, which I know you all do, you can really do this all by yourself. From scratch, even. Putting together a server is very easy thanks to Apache Friends. They have a wonderful distribution called XAMPP that is essentially a LAMP distribution. It's everything you need, including PHP, Apache, MySQL, all pre-configured. It goes on a Red Hat platform or a variety of other Linux platforms, and it's just one button install, and it's all running. I had a server. I set up a BitTorrent server for our podcasts, and I ordered the server, and I ordered a kind of a cheapo server, and it came with nothing on it, which I didn't realize. And I logged in. I said, oh, there's nothing on here. What am I going to do? And I found XAMPP, and man, boom, boom, it was running within 10 minutes. And I haven't changed a thing since. The other thing that is very hot right now and well worth looking into, if I were a programmer getting started right now and I wanted to be on the forefront of development for the internet, yeah, Java, yeah, PHP. I think the hottest, most interesting thing going on right now is something called Ruby on Rails. Ruby is a programming language, Japanese programming language, about 10 years old. A Japanese guy named Mats wrote it, and it's just fantastic. But Ruby on Rails is even better. Rails is an application framework that makes it very easy to develop data-based Web 2.0 applications. It's designed to work with MySQL, although it will work with any database. You don't have to know anything about the database. It's very natural. If you've done any programming at all, you'll be amazed at how quickly you'll get an application up. And the philosophy of Ruby on Rails is They call it convention, not configuration. The philosophy is that most applications are pretty much the same. So the way to develop an application, this goes against everything you learn in school, everything programmers have been taught for generations. You don't plan ahead. You don't spend a lot of time speccing it out. You might even just scratch out something on the back of a napkin. You get coding almost right away. And the way you develop the site is you write a very simple version of it with stuff you know you need, and then you turn it on, you let people play with it, and you slowly add to it as you watch what people do, as you learn what people need. And most of the Web 2.0 applications you're seeing now, the really cool stuff, a lot of it is written in Ruby on Rails. It gives you Ajax free. I mean, it's a very easy way to implement Ajax. So you could make a very slick, very modern, very powerful website really easily. It was created by a company called 37 Signals. And the reason I think it's so good is they developed it themselves for their own web applications. They do a thing called Backpack and Basecamp. They also have a couple of other great things which I use and I can't remember right now. But they're really a neat company. And as they did their development for their project manager, they realized they needed some tools. They created the tools and they gave them away. And that's what Ruby on Rails is. So it's certainly something to look at, Mark, if you're going to get into web design. John in Orange, welcome KFI. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Hello, John.
Hey, Leo, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for hanging on.
Good. Got a Windows XP problem. I sign on. When I first sign on, my screen all of a sudden is like I was supposed to have a 32-inch monitor or something. It's giant. And I can't see the start button. So,
I hate that. Now, if you move the mouse down to the bottom, does the screen scroll up?
No. I can go down in that bottom left-hand corner and click and get, or I can go into displays and change, the settings on the display.
Right.
And it'll be that way temporarily, but when I sign on again, it's back to the same old thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think what might have happened was there's a where I could go on to a newspaper that's here in Orange County on their website and look at their news on there. I wonder if there was automatically downloaded a driver or something that might have corrupted my system.
I don't think so. That would be that's pretty unlikely.
Yeah,
it's okay. Windows is just going a little crazy. That's all. You know what's happened is it's got the wrong settings for your monitor.
Mm-hmm.
It's decided that you have a different kind of monitor. The thing to do is to go into the display's control panel. It is possible on some monitors. For instance, I can set on my if I have the generic monitor driver installed, I can set my screen size to larger than my display can do. And is it an LCD or a CRT display?
It's a CRT.
Yeah, and now on an LCD, what'll happen if you make it too big is it'll just go off the screen. It'll be just like what you just described. Now, I'm not sure why that's happening on a CRT, but what I would do is open those display panel control properties. Display properties control panel. Uh-huh. Click the settings tab. Uh-huh. And you want to click the advanced tab and look and see what kind of monitor it thinks you have. If it is not accurate, if it's saying a plug-and-play monitor, that's wrong. And it's confused, and it's never going to give you settings that are appropriate. So you can go to the monitor manufacturer and download a new one. It's really just a text file that says it's a driver, a quote driver for a monitor. It's just a text file. That's all. It just says this is what size the monitor can do. This is what its refresh rates are and all that stuff. So really what you need is you need to make sure that you have the right monitor type in the display properties control panel.
Okay, yeah, I did that advanced, and it came up with the DPI setting, normal size 96 DPI.
Yeah, click the monitor tab there. See where it says monitor? What type of monitor do you have?
It's a KDS.
Is it correct?
Or
does it say plug-and-play monitor?
Boy, it says just default monitor.
I have to run for news anyway, but default monitor is wrong. Okay?
Oh.
So you what you want is you have to have the right monitor description in there. That's all it is. And then you'll be able to set it everything properly. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. News is next. I'll be back with more of your calls in just a bit, but first, Jessica Rosenthal in the KFI News Center.
May 14th, 2006.
KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 12:06, I'm Jessica Rosenthal, KFI News.
Thank you, Jessica. 1206 KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Got a little technical last hour with that web design question. I hope I didn't scare anybody off. I just think it's a pet subject of mine, of course, so I got into it a little more than I should have. But I also think it's really one of the most exciting things going on right now is how easy it is to create a website, a powerful website that could do things, really powerful things like Mark wanted to do, you know, organize a community or organize politics, keep track. I mean, just keep track of all sorts of stuff. Or, I mean, even nowadays, there are word processors and spreadsheets that are really just web applications. It's really a revolution in many ways of what's going on in the net. So I got a little excited. 1-800-520-1KFI is the phone number. Mike is in Diamond Bar. He's next on KFI. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Leo. Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Happy Mother's Day.
Question for you. Windows Defender. Yesterday I was online, mm-hmm. and I got my first warning come up.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Windows Defender is the former anti-spyware program, unnamed anti-spyware program that Microsoft bought from Giant.
Okay.
And they call it Defender now, and I think it's very, very good. So you got a Windows Defender warning that you had been attacked?
Yes, I believe so.
Wow.
Now, this is the first time I've run into anything, so I'm not sure if I did this right or anything, but under the actions to be taken,
mm-hmm.
I went to block it,
mm-hmm. good.
And an error message came up
saying
it could not take an action on this.
You know, that's one of the things that's really frustrating these days about spyware and to some degree viruses. Is that these great programs to defend you, these antivirus and anti-spyware programs, are helpless.
Great.
All I can do is warn you. So what? One of the things Defender's doing, did you install OneCare, or did you just install Defender, or?
Defender only.
Defender,
I've had it on here for about 3 months now, I believe, 2 or 3 months.
One of the things it does as part of its protection is it blocks outgoing connection attempts, kind of like a firewall would, like Zone Alarm would, for programs it doesn't know about or seem suspicious. Not all of these are bad.
Okay.
In fact, frequently I will allow it through because I, you know, and the time to do that is when you've just installed a new program and you're running it for the first time and you know that program connects to the internet. That would be a good example of a time when you would say, no, I meant that. I wanted that. I installed that. On the other hand, if you haven't done anything lately to change your computer and you're just surfing along or maybe not even surfing, maybe you're just, you know, doing something else and all of a sudden Defender says, somebody's trying to access the internet. Do you want to allow this, block this? What do you want to do? It probably is prudent to block it, unless you're sure it's prudent to block it. Now, you said you chose an option to remove. Is that what the choice was? Remove
it?
Yeah,
it said action to be taken, allow or block.
Right.
Now, I chose to block it, and then that's when the error message came up. It said action cannot be taken.
So it couldn't block it. Do you remember what else it said about the thing that was trying to get out?
No, it had a whole bunch of numbers on there.
Googly gobbledygook, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's the real problem also is that they give us information, but it's not information we can act on or do anything with.
Right now, I'm on the history page of Defender right now, actually.
Uh-huh. And what does it say?
And it says, action to be taken, blocked.
Okay,
but under there, it gives a description, advice, and resources.
Yeah.
Under the resources heading, it says firewall port HKLM. /system/current/control set.
Yeah.
/services.
Yeah.
/shared access. /parameters. /firewall policy. /standard profile. /globally open ports. And then /3426 UDP.
Ah, okay. That's what we really wanted. 3426
right.
UDP. All the rest of that is just a registry key. And what we want to do is find out what the heck uses 3624. And so I just did a Google on 3624. And I'm sorry, 3426. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm seeing a number of different programs that use it. So what I would suggest you do. That's the biggest clue. That's telling you what, in a way, what's going on. It's saying some program tried to access this port. Now, I think the thing, by the way, that Defender's doing is great. That's the kind of protection you really...
Yes, that's what I believe you should be doing. Yeah.
You really, really want.
Now, so, I one other quick question for you. On the same, I was actually on a blog yesterday on a friend's page on MySpace.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been on there, you know, before and everything. And I went to wish them, basically, you know, Happy Mother's Day today.
Mm-hmm.
And when I clicked on it, this is what came up. And that warning on their site, on their page. Now, I immediately went off of there because Windows Defender, you know. And so after I went through the Windows Defender thing, I went back on their site, and it came up again. But under a different number of, instead of 3426, 3427. So I'm getting two.
That's not unusual. Now, the other thing you have to understand is that this is an imperfect science, and so I believe Defender's accurate saying somebody's trying to access this port. The question is, what is it? Who is trying to access it, and why? Now, on one security site, I see the Archivio storage protocol, which I've
I saw that.
Yeah, I have no idea what that is.
Neither do I. I can't find any info on either one of them.
So you've done this Google search.
Yes, I have. What do I do? Try to block ports, or
Well, do you have a router or some other? Okay,
yes, I do. Yeah.
The problem with routers is that they don't monitor outbound traffic. The way a router protects you is it assumes that anything you're initiating is okay, mm-hmm. but anything that an outside source initiates that you didn't ask for, it drops. And that's really most of the time. That's what you want for firewall protection. The reason Defender watches outgoing connection attempts is because that can come from spyware or something else on your system.
Okay.
Any port above 1024 is kind of fair game. The ports below 1024 are reserved for common network services, things like, you know, email and web surfing and so forth.
Yeah, I've already kind of looked up the ports, and like I say, I don't know what to do. Where do I go with this? If I'm going onto the Windows Defender history page itself,
it sounds like it's blocking it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and now, do I go to my friends and say, "Hey, what's on with your page going on here?"
I doubt it. What is he running on Blogger?
Yeah, it's on MySpace.
MySpace.
Yes.
MySpace. Okay,
yes, yes.
That's interesting.
A lot of the news lately.
You know, one of the things about MySpace, I think the issue of the teens, danger to teens and predators and so forth. That's one thing certainly, but I think there are a lot of places where teens can get in trouble.
Yeah.
Many of them not online. I think the bigger issue to me with MySpace is it's essentially created by a online marketing company.
Right.
And who verge very close into the spyware advertising realm. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if you actually were stuff going on in MySpace. Hmm. Let's see. I'm looking at MySpace and now port 3426 to see if anybody's flagged that. The trick is, let's find out what program, and I don't see, I can't tell, by the way. I think you've done the same search. I don't see any obvious thing, but the trick is to find out what program is trying to open that port. I guess the next step, if you're really nervous about it, is to put a firewall on your system. And there's only one free one that I recommend. It's called Carrio Personal. It's from sunbeltsoftware.com, sunbelt-software. And it's absolutely free. It's a very good personal firewall. I'm not a huge fan of running software firewalls only because I consider them, often causing problems. In this case, I think you have a good reason to. You'd really like to make sure that nothing is going out through that port. So a couple of things to do. First thing I would do is go online and go to Shields Up and see if your ports are stealthed, see if your incoming traffic is blocked. It doesn't tell you anything about outgoing. It just tells you about incoming, just to make sure that your router is properly configured and you're blocked. Next thing I would do is I would go out and I would download Carrio Personal, sunbelt-software.com. And I would install it, and then I would have it run and watch and see what, maybe go back to your friend's site on MySpace. Check it out. See what it is that is causing the problem. And I think Carrio will tell you a lot more about it. This is a case where a software firewall probably is a good idea. You might not want to have it on all the time, or you might not want to install it and keep it permanently. But at least for investigating this, I think it's a good idea. What is that? Why? Anybody have an idea? Port 3426. And is it tied to MySpace? And what exactly is it? And so forth. 1-800-520-1KFI. I'll put this information in the show notes. Maybe you can add to it. There's a little comment box at the bottom. Simple enough to get there. You just go to KFIAM640.com. Click the shows button and my name, Leo Laporte. And once you get there, you'll be able to enter it in under the official website. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM640. More stimulating talk radio. It's 1217. It's 1222 on KFI AM640, more stimulating talk radio. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 1-800-520-1KFI is the phone number, 1-800-520-1534. Ben and Irvine, welcome to KFI.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, Ben.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. And your speakers, Desiree and Sean, are great. Thank you.
Yes, they are.
Leo, and happy Mother's Day to all mothers.
Thank you.
All the way. Leo, I can't get my Windows to start. I'm running PC 2000 NT Professional on my desktop, and it's networked to a laptop, but the laptop's fine.
And what happened when, what did you do, or what was the last thing you did before this problem began?
The last thing I did Friday night, about 11 o'clock, I was burning some CDs. And it was with NeuroBurn, but I had two different icons. One was just a regular NeuroBurn, and the other one was, it said NeuroBurn 2.
Okay.
And
did it crash in the middle of the burn? Or did something?
Well, the first one, it did completely fine on the plain NeuroBurn. On the second one, NeuroBurn 2, it only did 95% of it. And I was locked up. I couldn't go anywhere. And after about an hour's worth of time, I just, after pressing escape, delete, control, alt, delete, and everything, I just pushed the off button on the desktop. On the tower.
Did you press it and hold it, or did you press it and, I mean, did it do a shut? It didn't do a regular shutdown. You turned it off.
Yes.
Yeah. And then when you came back in the next day and turned it on, what happened?
His phone broke up.
We just lost him. Oh, rats. We may never know. Well, I'm going to presume that it's not booting at all. Couple of possibilities, and it's impossible to tell from what we know which it is. So I'm just going to leave you with the possibilities. One is coincidental, had nothing to do with Nero burning or anything else. The hard drive died. They do, you know, and died in a kind of spectacular way, such a way that it cannot, in fact, start a computer up. I wish I did know from him what the symptoms were when you started up, because that will tell you a little bit about what's wrong. If it says no operating system found, yeah, your hard drive died. If it just starts up and then freezes, it may be that your hard drive had an error, and it had an error in a critical portion of the system software. And so when that part tries to load, boom, you get a big crash. Now, there are two different kinds of hard drive errors. There are physical errors. We call them sometimes hard errors. And there are formatting errors or data errors, and those are called soft errors. A hard error you can't recover from, especially if it's in a bad space on the hard drive. There's nothing to do to fix a hard error. If it's in a kind of a non-consequential space, if it's just in a plain old data space on the hard drive, you can sometimes map around it, just say, oh, don't use that area. All hard drives have some bad data areas. That's not necessarily fatal. On the other hand, if it's in the master boot record or a key area of the hard drive that Windows needs to use, you're going to be out of luck. You're going to need a new hard drive. But that's a hard error. That's a physical error. Soft errors can happen for all sorts of things. Let's say as you were writing, the program actually hadn't crashed or was in the process of writing to the hard drive, or something was going on when you turn it off. If you turn off a machine in the middle of a write to a hard drive, that's the worst possible thing that you can do, because, of course, all of a sudden it's sending out, spitting out electrons onto that hard drive. It loses power. The head skitters across the drive, spewing electrons as it goes, and it can, you know, overwrite or trash the drive, the contents of the drive. Often that's just a soft error, though, and if you were to take the drive out, format it, put Windows back on, it would work just fine. So those are the two different possible errors. I can't tell from what you've told me which it is. What do you do going forward? You could try to rescue it. First thing to do is, well, can we get Windows back up and running at all? We'd like to get the data off of that drive, for instance. One way to try that, in fact, it's best to try, you know, if you really have a serious crash like this, to start with non-destructive fixes. If you were to bring it to me in a shop, the first thing I would do is I'd pull the drive out of the computer. I might even put a new drive, a working drive, known working drive in and see if the computer works. Make sure it's not the computer. I didn't even mention that, but it could be the computer, right? It could be just it died. So let's make sure the computer is working. That's a quick and easy thing to do. Yes, it's working? Okay. So now we have a drive with some problems. First thing you might want to do is make a, and in the store you could do this, you have all these tools, you might want to make a perfect copy of it, a ghost, a bit-for-bit copy of it, so that if you do anything to the drive, you can always get back to the way it was before. We're going to treat your data like it's gold, like it's precious, so we're going to make sure we don't lose a drop of it. We're going to copy everything bit-for-bit. Then we might try some rescue attempts on it. First thing you might do is put the Windows install disk in and run the recovery routines. See if we can rewrite whatever portions of Windows might have been damaged and get the thing limping up. Our goal here is to get the data off the drive. Can't do that, maybe put in a working, known working good system and see if you can even just see the drive. And if you can see it, copy the data off. That's the kind of thing a computer store can do well because they have extra machines. They can pull your drive out. They've got the tools. They put it in the new machine. They boot the new machine. They see your drive. They see the data. They copy the data over. You're good. You're golden. Once we get the data off the drive, then we format it, reinstall Windows, see if it runs, see if it's okay. Maybe run check disk, or if you've got SpinWrite, that's a great time to get SpinWrite out. If you can see the drive at all, SpinWrite could, you know, SpinWrite is a really useful tool for soft errors. It won't fix the physical damage. It can help map around physical damage, but it's not going to fix anything. But it can fix soft errors. So maybe that's the next step is to run SpinWrite in the drive. See if the drive's integrity is it still there, if it's working. See if we can reformat it. If we can, we can put it back in the service. Making sure to back up regularly, of course. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. 1229, Jessica Rosenthal's in the KFI News Center.
Captain Dale Dye, this evening, 5 to 7.
KFI AM 640.
1236 on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. A comment in the show notes from D. Petawal. D-Pete-Wall. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. He says he can't find the website. Well, obviously you found it or you wouldn't have been able to put the comment on there. But yes, they did move the link on KFI. You go to KFIAM640.com and they have this little bit of a JavaScript pop-down under shows. So you hover over shows or you click on shows and you'll see Leo Laporte. Click that. That'll take you to my page on the KFI website. And then I'm going to see if I can get them to change this terminology. They say official website, which is confusing. Under my picture, you see those three links. Official website, that's the show notes page. I'm going to get them to change it to the show notes page or something. Or just go to leo.am. You know, that would be the other way to do it. And that'll take you right there. So sorry about the confusion. Moving on to our next call, Jim in Los Angeles. Welcome to KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi,
hello,
Leo,
Jim.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Okay, happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to you too, sir.
All right.
We're okay. A couple of mothers, but no mothers.
Yes.
Yes.
Here's my issue. I'm an old geezer. I have a CD from Woodstock way back when.
Were you there, Jim?
Yes, sir.
Oh, how cool.
Yes, sir.
You know, my 11-year-old is fascinated by Woodstock, and somebody sent me some old tickets. Which I had framed and I gave to him, and he just loves it. He loves the idea. He says, Dad, why weren't you at Woodstock? I said, why my parents wouldn't let me go. So I'm jealous, Jim. That sounds great.
Actually slept in a barn overnight.
Oh, my
concert.
Goodness. Oh, how cool.
Yeah. Anyway, the CD that I have was designed for QuickTime 1.1.
Whoa.
And for Windows 95.
Oh, my gosh.
I am now running Windows XP Home.
Right, and QuickTime's up to 7.1, so.
Yeah, and I'm having some difficulty trying to figure out how I can play this thing for my daughter so I can pass on that little bit of history.
Hey, that's cool. Where'd you get the, is it a video you took, or?
No, this is a video from MPC.
Okay.
Was purchased from someplace here in Southern
cool.
California,
all
long
right.
before I got out here.
So the issue is that CD is just a data disk, right? And on there is a .mov file, right?
Right. It has the music. It has video. interviews,
when
all
you,
that kind of stuff.
Now, I presume you have QuickTime, and you open it.
Yes.
Can you open those .mov files from within QuickTime?
Yes.
And what happens?
Some of them I can play. For instance, I can play the ones that have the QuickTime logo will play.
Okay.
But the entire CD will not play, and it just won't work correctly.
At one point, you were able to play it, though.
Yes, when I was with the old Windows 95.
So you'd put it in, and it would play as if it were a DVD. It would play. You'd get a user interface. You'd have different videos and clips and so forth, and it would play.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's probably what we call a VCD or some sort of format. There were before DVD. There were a number of different ways of putting video on a CD that would play kind of like a DVD.
Well, let me tell you what it says on the back of the package, Leo.
Yeah.
If that's okay.
Yeah.
It says system requirements PC with 386 DX.
Oh, I know what it is.
Or higher processor.
I realize what it is. This is a multimedia disc. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, multimedia. Oh boy, this was very big. About 10 years ago, before the internet really took off, everybody agreed, incorrectly as it turned out, that the next big thing would be multimedia CDs.
Okay.
And there were, I don't know, I mean, if you were around then, you remember there were lots of titles of these multimedia CDs, and they were so cool, and they had, you know, rich media, and almost all of them flopped. I mean, it was typical that these would sell 100 copies, and that's all. They cost millions to produce. So the market quickly imploded, and they went away. What this is, and the reason you're having trouble, is not so much the QuickTime. What this is... there's a program on that disc, probably in Macromedia Director, that is supposed to auto run in Windows. And the problem is it's a Windows 95 program. It isn't running on Windows XP. It doesn't run. It's as if you had software from that era. It is software, and
right.
and it won't run. And I don't think, short of getting a Windows 95 machine together, you're not going to ever be able to run that disc as it was then.
Bummer.
You can get the media off of it. I mean, it's not lost. The media that's on it is still playable in most cases. But what you're never going to get is there. You're going to have to somehow. You might be able to reassemble it if you got all the pieces off of it. The key is that there's a program on there that can't run in Windows 95.
Okay. Windows XP.
Yeah, rather XP. It's designed for 95.
Right.
I'm going to guess, I don't know, but most of the time those were written in Macromedia Director. That was the multimedia authoring program of choice. It's still around, by the way, although more people do stuff in Flash more, which is kind of its cousin, its close cousin. I think one way to get this thing to work would be to see if you could find a more modern player, a director player, that ran under Windows XP, copied all the media assets off of that CD, and tried to play it with the more modern player. So there's going to be some files on there. There'll be the QuickTime files are MOV files. What you need to look is at the file extensions.
Okay.
And what we want to find is the director, the key director file that was the file that controlled it all. Are there any EXEs on there?
I don't really know, Leo. I don't have it in this
okay.
machine now.
So the EXEs may be troublesome. Those would be the actual the actual EXE programs may not run well in Windows XP. But the other files, the data files, should run fine. So okay. what you want to do is find the director files. Now there's a number of file extensions for Macromedia Director
okay.
that you're gonna be looking for. In fact, there's so many. I'm not gonna. What I'll try to do is find a list of them, and what you're gonna do is copy those all off onto a hard drive, and then download. I'll put a link to that also in the show notes if I can find it. A director player for you, and kind of try to recreate that CD. If you can get it all working, you could burn it again. And it would play again
with something like Nero.
Yeah, but what you're doing is you're gonna you know, like, for instance, there'll be a DIZ file. What you're going to do is you're going to be looking for all of these little Macromedia Director files. If it's in Director, the key is I'm not sure what it's in, so I can't figure it out. You understand, though, what's happened is that you have this old multimedia disk, basically.
Right.
Yeah. And
incompatibility.
It's just incompatible. A multimedia disk is software. It's not a DVD. I mean, DVD is software, too. And the truth is, if we didn't have DVD players, we in 10 years, it might be impossible to play a DVD. Your kids might be trying to show their kids, you know, video of the latest Bare Naked Ladies concert, and they won't be able to play it. So that's what happens often with these media formats. I'll tell you what, I'll see if what I can do is I'll see if I can find some listings of the file types you're going to look for and a director player. And if you pull them all off, you might be able to play with a director player. Okay, Jim, I thank you for the call. It's worth trying to recover. But I just think of all the multimedia CDs that are out there. Millions, probably. Well, maybe not. Because they didn't sell all that well in the first place. But there was some great stuff made. There were games. I used to review multimedia CDs for a PBS show. And there was some really amazing, you know, art museum tours and so forth. But most of them won't run anymore. One other thing you might try, Jim, if it says it's Mac compatible, you might try it on a Mac. But it may not run on OS 10. You might have to find a Mac with OS 9 on an older Mac. It's going to run an older, this is ironic, but it's going to run on an older computer, but not a newer. Jackie in Malibu, welcome KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Jackie.
Hey, Leo. I'm looking to buy a new computer, a laptop, and I just wondered about that issue of watching TV through your computer.
Mm-hmm. You want to be able to?
Yeah.
So what you need is, and this is a little harder with a laptop, a lot of desktops have TV in. You need a TV, some device that's going to take the TV signal and display it on your screen. Are you going to be connecting to a cable box, a satellite box? What are you going to connect to?
Probably satellite, like DirecTV.
Okay. So the DirecTV requires a decoder. That's that cable box or the satellite box that you have. You're not going to be able to. You're not going to be able to eliminate that.
Okay.
You're going to have to hook your laptop up to that. Do you want to, is that what you want to do, or do you want to watch stuff on the internet?
Well, no, I would, well, both, but
you want to be mobile. I mean, what's the point of sitting next to your satellite receiver?
Well, yeah, so it's like an umbilical cord, but there's nothing wireless.
You might as well watch TV, right?
Yeah, there's nothing wireless that works.
I think the best thing for you is something called a sling box. And
I heard you talk about that last week, I think, or yesterday.
I think this might be what you want.
Yeah.
So what it is, it's a really ugly, we were talking about it with somebody, I think last week. It's a really ugly device. It looks like a silver painted plastic gold brick. And what it does is it'll hook up to your, you leave it in your house, and it hooks up to your DirecTV receiver. And your DirecTV receiver goes into it, if you had a TiVo go into it, a DVD player, whatever. All of your home entertainment stuff goes right into the back of it.
Okay.
And then one other thing goes in the back of it. And this you need. You need high-speed internet. Do you have high-speed internet?
Yes.
So you plug the Ethernet cable. You may need, if right now you have a cable modem hooked up to one computer, you're going to need to get one of those sharing boxes, a broadband router.
Well, I have a wireless D-Link router.
Yeah, wireless isn't going to do it.
Oh.
So what you need, and your D-Link router probably has wired connections also. Most of them do. So look on the back. It might have four extra ports where you'd plug an Ethernet cable.
Oh, okay. So I just need it for this one computer.
Just for that one. Mm-hmm. Not even for the computer. Just for the sling box.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
The sling box has to be connected. You could do
by
it wirelessly.
Ethernet.
But it's got an Ethernet port on the back. Exactly. So that gets connected to your router. And now what the sling box is doing is it's a little web server. It's putting the contents of your DirecTV receiver on the internet.
Okay.
And you now take your laptop and anywhere you can get online, in a hotel room or a cafe, anywhere, you log in to your sling box. It takes a password so no one else can do it. And you can see what's on your home entertainment center over the internet.
What was the price on those things?
Oh, I think they're $250.
Oh, okay.
Not horribly expensive. In fact, I think
they're... How big is How big is it in terms of dimensions?
It's like a gold brick. It's it's about 9-10 inches long and about 3 or 4 inches wide. It's small. If you go to slingmedia.com, you can see a picture of it.
Okay.
And I'll put one in the show notes. Now, that gives you, I think, what you want, which is ability to watch on your laptop, as long as your laptop can get online.
Right.
Which means even on your own network, if you've got a wireless network, you can now take the laptop into the garden.
Right.
And watch what's on the DirecTV.
That's what I want to do.
I think this is what you want. It also works on a mobile phone running Windows Mobile 5. The only caveat is because you're running on the internet, it's not going to be, it'll be a little, the picture won't be as quite as good.
Mm-hmm.
A little smaller. And you know, if the internet,
what does it look like? Video on?
Go to, you know, it's hard to describe. It depends on your internet connectivity. So if
CBS, they have some internet.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. If you watch, that's very much what it's like. If you go to,
so I can look at that.
CBS.com/innertube. Which is their
innertube.
Great name. If you go, don't get me started. Anyway, so if you go to that site, that's pretty much what the Sling Box will look like. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not awful.
Okay. Yeah. One other quick question.
Sure.
When I installed my D-Link wireless router a long time ago, like 2 years ago, I don't think I have WPA encrypted.
You may not. You probably have WEP. The early ones had WEP. Now, the only thing wrong with WEP, it was badly designed and it's easily cracked.
Uh-huh.
But what a hacker has to do is sit out in your driveway.
Yeah, and I've gone to see where on the property it could even be accessed.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay. Okay, well, that takes care of me.
You could go to D-Link's site and see if there's an update. If there is, I would use it. But, I mean, somebody has to be pretty dedicated and run some sophisticated software to crack it. Thank you for the call, Jackie. Slingbox is a very cool product. It really is. 12:50, 10 away from 1. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
Matt Drudge, tonight 7 to 10.
KFI AM 640.
12:55 on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy here. Mizuguchi 42 on the show notes mentioned for Jim, who wanted to play back one of those older multimedia CDs, that you could try the Windows compatibility mode. This is something that is in XP, kind of as a response to the fact that once they came out with XP, a lot of older programs, Windows 95 programs, wouldn't work. And so they put in this compatibility mode. The way you try it is you right-click on the program file you want to launch and select compatibility. The problem with it is, what they mean by compatibility is pretty limited. They, for instance, will try to trick the program into thinking it's running on 95. But if the program is truly incompatible, it ain't going to work. It is really a trick. I mean, there's a few things. It'll allow you to change it to 256 color mode. A few things you can do. So you right-click on the program .exe file, select properties, compatibility, and then you can choose to, say, trick it into Windows 95. My experience has been that works in a very limited subset of programs. It really only works in programs that have, have built into the program a check for the Windows version. And then, you know, if it says, I never heard of this version, it just won't run. So it can trick those programs. But if there's a real incompatibility, of which there are many, it's never going to work. It's kind of a shame. But that's, you know, that's a kind of a good warning bell for all of us. We're all going to be faced with media incompatibilities as the computer era matures. We already know that many of the formats we have and have used no longer work. If you have a DOS program, you can't expect to run it in Windows XP. If you have a Jazz drive or an Orb drive, if you have an old PsyQuest drive, even in some cases, if you had floppies, you may not be able to run those anymore. Many of the old multimedia CDs will no longer work. Therefore, Windows 95, they don't work on the modern operating systems. We're in the era, kind of a disposable era. Now, one of the answers to this, and it's a good answer, is not to make it reliant on any particular operating system, to use open standards. That's why I'm a big proponent of open standards, not saying it's got to be Windows, not saying it's got to be Windows 95. Make it as open as you can, and the likelihood it'll be able to play later is better. But even when you back up data nowadays, you really got to think. And what we really want to think about is all of our pictures, all of our video, all the stuff we're saving of our kids, of these great moments. You know, we used to just take pictures, printed pictures. They never go wrong, right? They might wear out. They might crackle in the sun, but you can always look at them. Well, if they're on a computer, there's no guarantee. You have to constantly update it. Move your pictures to the new format. You have to back them up to the CD. You know, 10 years from now, will we still have CD players? I don't know. Time for news. We'll talk more in just a bit. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio at 1259. Jessica Rosenthal is in the KFI News Center.
May 14th, 2006.
Low clouds and fog will roll in late tonight. We'll have lows in the 50s and 60s. 75 right now in Irvine, 66 in Newport Beach, 68 in Santa Monica, and 74 in Glendale. KFI is the talk station that does live local news on the hour, on the half, and when it breaks. At 106, I'm Jessica Rosenthal, KFI News.
Thank you, Jessica. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. 1-800-520-1KFI is the phone number. 1-800-520-1534. Let's get back to the phones. David in Fort Lauderdale, you're next on KFI. Hi, David.
Yes, Leo. How are you?
Great.
I have a older Dell laptop running Windows XP.
Mm-hmm.
And as you've talked about before, both the hinges are broken.
Oh, dear.
Now I have a couple of keys that aren't working. So I would like to try to relocate the hard drive to another Dell laptop.
Yes.
I've tried it. I basically get a black screen with a flashing cursor.
The probable issue is booting off of it. So the data is fine. It's just that that laptop has drivers for the other laptop. The drive has drivers for the other laptop on it. So it may not boot well from it. Let's see what the best... I mean, if they were identical laptops, that should work. But they're obviously... Are they considerable difference in the age?
Yeah, they're a couple of years apart.
Yeah. You know, all of the system drivers are different, and I think that's probably why it's crashing on you.
Is there any software that makes that transition?
No, I mean, I think the only way you could do it is to pull the data off of that drive, reformat the drive. See, if you use the system, you could run the Dell system recovery on it. But if you do that, it's going to erase everything. Is there data on that drive you need? Obviously, there must be, or you wouldn't be moving it over.
Yeah, it's definitely got a lot of good stuff on it.
Yeah,
I do a repair it? Windows.
You could
repair.
Try it. You could try it. It's not so much that the Windows files are damaged. It's that it has drivers for the old motherboard, and when it tries to load those, obviously the video driver in particular is failing.
Right.
A recovery won't fix that. Let me think if there's... You might be able to go into safe mode. Did you try to boot into safe mode?
No.
I would try that. You know, press F8 as you boot. And with any luck, the basic drivers... One of the things that safe mode does is it loads a generic VGA driver. With any luck, the basic drivers will be enough to get the thing started. If that's the case, then you can get drivers for that newer Dell and install them. And with any
drivers.
Yeah, because that's probably what's going on there.
Okay, and if I try to move all my information to a new hard drive using something like Aloha Bob?
Yeah, that'll work. That's the idea. The whole reason for Aloha Bob is they move the files that aren't going to break Windows, but they leave Windows alone. So Aloha Bob will even work going from Windows 95 to Windows XP. It doesn't copy any of the Windows key Windows files. It only copies your data.
But it will copy all the programs.
To the degree it can, yeah. Yeah, that's an issue, isn't it? If you don't have the disks for those programs, that is an issue. It's very difficult to move Windows programs without the install disks.
Okay.
So that's going to be another issue.
So no quick fix for this problem.
I don't think so. I don't think anybody's written a special magic, you know, move one drive from one laptop to another disk. See, if for a desktop, it's not a big deal. You just have it as your secondary disk. And that might be the best thing, by the way, is get an external drive case for a laptop drive. They're different. They're 2.5-inch drives.
Right. I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. You get an external drive case, put that old drive in there, keep the original drive in the new Dell, and just plug in via USB 2 or FireWire, plug in the old drive, and you'll see everything. Copy it over.
It'll show my programs or just data?
It'll show your programs. Whether they'll run is another issue. Some programs will, but many programs require that the system that is booted, that is the Windows off the new drive, have in registry and in its directory all the DLLs and all the entries. Some programs will. In a way, I think it's a form of copy protection. Really, if you don't have the disks for the program, what are you doing trying to run it, right?
Alrighty. Okay, I appreciate it.
Sorry, David. I wish there were better advice for you. I don't know of any way. Maybe somebody does, and if they do, certainly call or put it in the show notes. But as far as I know, what you're trying to do is difficult. Nick Anaheim, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Nick.
Leo, I have a question about a Canon camera,
yes, sir.
Digital camera. I'm wondering what your opinion is of the PowerShot, and specifically the model S2IS.
PowerShot. I'm not sure I know which one the S2. Let me look it up. The S2IS, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like the PowerShots. I'm not sure about that particular model, so let me look at it and see
This has got 5 megapixels, 12 times optical, and image stabilization.
Excellent. 12 times optical. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of zoom.
I'm aware. I've got a Fuji that's got 10, and it almost does as good with as my son's EOS with with the big image stabilization.
Well, I'll tell you, I haven't used this camera, but Canon makes excellent cameras. By the time you get to this camera, you're very close to a digital SLR.
Right.
So, how much does it cost?
$379 on sale today.
That's a great price. I'd have no hesitation recommending it. I think they make very good cameras. The PowerShots are good. The S2s are good. 12X is amazing. The one thing you might want to do before you put down your money is go to digitalcamerainfo.com and read their review of it. They're very good about these things, and they will highlight any real issues with it. Just in case there's some particular issue. But my general recommendation is it's very good.
Okay, are there any other websites that I could also check?
DP Review is very good, too. There are a number of good camera review websites. I like digitalcamerainfo.com because I know them to be absolutely religiously independent. So
I will give them a shot.
They don't take any money from anybody. They have advertisers, but they keep a very good wall between the two. Now I'm looking. They have a number of Canons. In fact, I think their number one camera is number one and number two cameras are Canons. And I don't see. Let's see. There it is. They seem to like it. The S2IS. They say SLR like.
Yes, it is. It's very
it looks a lot like an SLR. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think My issue when you have zoom that much, I'm glad you've tried it before, is it's hard to handheld a 12x zoom or a 10x zoom because you're zoomed in so far. But if you're comfortable with that.
Yeah, with the image stabilization, I feel that it probably is a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That makes a big difference. They seem to like it. I would read their review. If you want a second opinion, dpreview.com is also a very good site for that. Thank you, Nick. I appreciate it. Craig in Pasadena. KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Craig.
Hey. So I think I killed my router by upgrading uploading a third-party firmware to it.
Oh, no. You have a Linksys WRT? Were you putting that new?
Yeah, I was doing the Hyper WRT so I could add a little WDS.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I think that sounds very cool. What happened?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a couple days ago I was using it. Everything was fine. The whole reason was to use my Airport Express with it so I could, do the streaming and all that fun stuff.
Right.
But I was changing the IP address on my computer, and then all of a sudden it died, flashing a power indicator and nothing else. So I guess I looked online, and there's a couple different things that I read as far as, reflashing it or shorting the little flash chip on the board or whatever.
Right.
But so far, it's still doing the exact same thing. And
sounds like
trying to figure out.
Sounds
maybe
like
I'm
dead.
Something.
I don't know. You're really on the hairy edge once you start reflashing your things.
Right.
They were never intended to be reflashed. I think Hyper WRT is pretty good, but you know, you can't bring it back to Linksys. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's only a $30 router, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons people have hacked this WRT so much is because it's so cheap and it's so widely available and you know, so forth. But they die on their own, you know, and even if you didn't reflash it. How old is it?
Right. Well, I bought it used. So wow. I've been using it for probably a year. So.
Get a new one.
I know.
I don't know of any magic bullet. In fact, I'm surprised you can reflash it. Usually once you've got something non-working, it's kind of hard to reflash it.
Well, I didn't reflash it, but I shorted on the board, the little Intel flash chip. You can short two of the little pins, and I guess that kind of after that, you can TFTP a new firmware to it.
Oh, really? So you can actually get into it still? Huh.
Well, you can't really do the web interface, which, you know, that's how you do it normally, but, you know.
There's a way to get in there.
So far, nothing's worked out.
Yeah. You know, if it was used, it was a long time in service, it might just be that it just failed on you.
Time to go.
Time to get a new one. Sorry, Craig.
Oh, well.
But if somebody knows a trick for recovering a dead Linksys WRT 54G router, Craig would like to know. We put it in the show notes, and maybe we can figure out something for you, Craig. Thank you for the call. 1-800-520-1KFI. I'm here till 2. Another 45 minutes to go. Then it's Dr. Dean Adell. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio.
Handle on the news, warts and all. Tomorrow morning, 6 to 7. KFI AM 640.
122. KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. So glad you're here today. Hope you'll join me every Saturday and Sunday, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. as we talk about high tech. 1-800-520-1KFI is my phone number. Let's get back to the phones. It's Richard in Cerritos next. Welcome, Richard, to KFI.
Hi, can you hear me?
I hear you great. How you do?
Good. Okay, I got a email problem.
Yes, sir.
I use Outlook Express 6 with Windows 98 Second Edition. Every email that I forward or create adds an attachment, and the attachment is it's got the Explorer icon, and it goes ATT000.
Yeah. Right.
Then there's three numbers which change with each one.
Yep,
.htm.
Yep.
Oh, you know about that.
Oh, I know all about that. Yes.
Oh, good.
So, first of all, you can ignore it. But if it's bugging the people who are getting your email, what it is if you create HTML emails, it attaches, when Outlook Express sends the email, it sends several versions. It sends a plain text version, and then it sends as an attachment the HTML for the HTML email.
Uh-huh.
And some people, not all, but some people who receive that email can't see HTML email. And so what they get instead is a text version of it with an attachment that they could open up in their browser. And that's what that ATT001.htm is.
Oh.
Now, if you don't want it to be sending that, you could tell Outlook Express to stop sending HTML mail, to send all your mail as plain text, which I, by the way, recommend.
Oh, really?
Well, HTML mail is nice because you can put images in there. You can have fonts. It's pretty.
Yeah.
It's bad for a couple of reasons. My chief argument against it is it's a security problem. Not so much because you're sending a bad emails. Your email's fine. But people who read HTML email open themselves up to all of the browser security flaws that are out there because you're essentially using a browser to read email. And spammers use some tricks in HTML email to check to see if you're reading it. You can embed malicious programs in it. So I tell people to turn off the capability to not use HTML email, to turn it off. And sending it also, it's large files and so forth. So if you turn that off, you won't see those attachments anymore.
Okay. If I send pictures or anything, would it change those?
Well, they'll go as attachments now.
Okay.
And so instead of the ATT001.htm, you'll see myshot.jpg. You'll see an attached JPEG. Now, the disadvantage of this is now people, and you'll get complaints because people say, oh, you know, it was so cool, Richard. You'd send me a picture. It would be embedded in the email. I'd see it in the email. And now they'll say, oh, you know, I have to open up this file.
Oh, okay.
So that's the disadvantage of that. It's probably okay to keep using HTML email. It's really more, I object to it more as a receiver. I turn that feature off in my email program. And I'm going to see, that's why I know what this attachment is, because I'm going to see it.
Okay.
And that's, so it's nothing to worry. Tell them, don't worry. It's just something, you know, if you want to see what this mail looked like when I sent it, open up that file in your browser. And then it'll look really cool. Jim in San Pedro, welcome. KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Love the show and Thanks, Jim. Your podcast.
Oh, good. Thank you. Which ones do you listen to?
This show.
Oh, good. Yeah. I'm a little behind, but I'm catching up on those now. I'll be caught up by this week, I think. I put out a bunch more.
Yeah, I listened to 236. That's the last one I downloaded.
I'm up to 242, baby.
I know. I got to catch up.
See, that's why people don't complain, because it's a long podcast. And, you know, by the time I send out this show, it's an hour and a half worth of material. So.
Yeah, but it's great to be able to listen to it at my convenience.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
So, I did some work out of town. I was staying out of town for a month. I decided to bring my main office computer up there so I could keep the workflow going.
Yeah.
And I'm usually hooked up to a cable modem at the house with a router firewall. So I have my internal Microsoft firewall turned off normally, because I'm sharing various folders with other
office computers. It can get in the way of file sharing, yep.
Yeah. So I take it up there. Not thinking, I plug that computer straight into the wall internet connection. I pay for their internet connection.
Sure.
And everything's great for about a week. And all of a sudden, I come back into my room a week later, and Norton has found about 26 viruses on the system. And it was one virus, came back up and said it's a backdoor SD bot.
Yeah.
And it showed it as an install.exe file,
right.
But what it actually did was it took the shotgun approach to my computer and threw out all these autorun.inf files,
right,
just all over the place.
Right.
So apparently it caught it. It deleted all the viruses.
Really?
It didn't
so it
damage
says.
Any data.
Okay.
But what the
Forgive
problem
me if
is,
I'm skeptical, but go ahead, yes?
Well, no, I know. I haven't been able to find any corrupted data.
Wow, that's great. You've been very lucky. Okay.
I know that. I totally know that.
Yeah.
But what happens is I'll come in, and all of a sudden two applications will be running just randomly. MSGS.exe, which I know has something to do with Microsoft,
right.
You know, the chat thing, whatever.
Right.
And then ccapp.exe, which I just found out might have something to do with Norton. But they'll be running, and they won't run at the same time, but I'll come in and I'll hear the processor going full speed ahead, and I'll look.
Yeah.
99% of the resources
I don't
are
think
going
you're,
for either one of these.
I don't think you're clean.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. This SD bot, what it does is it puts you on a botnet. An IRC chat room where you are then under the control of the hacker. I think he's rootkitted you. He's put other things on there that you can't see, and I think that these are symptoms that the hacker still has access to your computer. Your only recourse at this point, back up your data, format, and reinstall. It is the only way you can be sure that you are safe. I think you've been rooted. You've got rootkits on there. That's really serious stuff and very hard to detect. The very fact that the antivirus you're running says you're clean is a sign that it's worse than you think.
I've done three of them. I've got AVG loaded on here.
Yeah,
as well.
But if it's a rootkit, they can't see them.
They're not seeing it.
So, hey, we got to take a break. Let me talk a little more about this in a minute. Okay, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Jessica Rosenthal's in the KFI News Center. If you have high-speed internet and you're paying more than $12.95 a month, and I warrant you probably are, I can save you money. If you have dial-up and you're paying more than $12.95 a month, and you are if you're using AOL or if you have a second phone line, I can save you some money. I can tell you how you can get high-speed internet from one of the best internet service providers in the country for just $12.95 a month. That's right. The best costs less. That's hard to believe, but it is true when it comes to DSL Extreme. They're my internet service provider, so I know what I'm talking about. You get great service from them. No spam, no viruses, 24-hour free tech support. And you know what? There's no setup fees. The modem is free. This is guaranteed for a year. It's not some cheesy tease. This is the deal. The guaranteed lowest price in the country for high-speed internet. Call 866-2-GET-NET. 866-2-GET-NET or visit them online at dslextreme.com. It's true high-speed internet. For the lowest price in the country, $12.95 a month, only from DSL Extreme.
K
KFI Weekends, the stimulating talk you want, and the Southern California news you need.
KFI AM 640.
KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. Show notes are online at leo.am or just go to the KFI website, kfiam640.com, where you see the show's link. Hover over that, click my name, Leo Laporte, and then when you get to my page, you see my picture on the right there, click official website. Or just go, as I said, to leo.am. Some good hints in the show notes from Anonymous. I wish I had the name because he gives us some great advice. For our caller, Richard, no, I'm sorry, it was Craig, who had crashed his Linksys. They call that bricking your router, that is turning it into a brick. And there is a revival guide from linksysinfo.org for people who have bricked their router. Apparently a way to revive it, and some really interesting tricks that I would never have thought of, some of which involve actually, doing some of the things I think Craig might have tried, which is opening up the router itself and shorting out stuff. And anyway, some great tips on that. So if you've bricked your router, I love that phrase, as Craig did, go to our show notes and we have a link there. Thanks to Anonymous. Great stuff. Some really great stuff in the comments. At the bottom of the page, there's a comment box. You can add to the show notes if you have a suggestion, a correction. Some good advice for David in Fort Lauderdale, who is attempting to move his hard drive from one XP system to another, two different Dell laptops. And I said, you know, it's really hard to get that working. In the old days, in Windows 95, 98, you could delete all the devices in the device manager while the drive is in the old machine. Just delete, you know, remove all the devices. Now, of course, it won't run anymore. You shut it down. And then the idea was when you put it in the new system, it will plug and play, it'll find all the drivers, and all of a sudden it'll work again because you've deleted the old drivers, or at least deleted references to the old drivers. They still are on the hard drive. With XP, that technique does not seem to work. I've tried it and tried it many times, and it just doesn't seem to work. However, there is somebody in the show notes, listener RV, who says you can do it. Essentially the same idea. His suggestion, though, this is one added thing that I've never tried that might make the difference, is to change the hard drive controller in the device manager to standard IDE controller. Now, this will slow it down. This will make it a little less powerful, but it makes it more compatible. He thinks, and I think he might be right, that the real issue is that the hard drive controller in the newer laptop is different. It's a, you know, it's an ATA 100 controller or some other kind of controller compared to the old laptop. And that's probably true. Windows doesn't like that. In fact, when you're first installing Windows XP, if you don't have a up-to-date install disk, if you don't have a Service Pack 2 install disk, you have to press F6 at the beginning of the install and put in the device drivers for the new drive, or you won't even see the driver, right? Can't see the hard drive because these new hard drives, Windows XP, the original version, had no idea about ATA 100 drives. So listener RV put a series of suggestions. I think they're probably worth trying. So he says change the IDE controller to standard, clean out any that's in the old system, then you move it to the new system, boot it up, clean out any phantom devices. He's got some command line statements, and I think that's probably worth a try. It may just be that the hard drive controller is incompatible. That's a good suggestion. That's why these show notes are so valuable. I really appreciate your contributions. Marie Glendale, KFI, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, Marie. Welcome to KFI.
Hi, Leo. My question is, I need to know your recommendation for what kind of laptop I could get for my sister.
Okay.
She's in a nursing home. She had a stroke. She's paralyzed on one side. Oh. She can only use her left hand.
Oh, wow.
And she does need some speech therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gotten her a CD kit. I'd like her to be able to use it interactively with her left hand and a mouse.
Okay.
Need something that's light enough that she can lift with one hand, but also that's probably the only reason she would use the laptop. So I don't need something that is
it's very powerful,
but something reliable, sturdy that she might drop on occasion. Hopefully not.
Is the Is the software on a CD? Or, I mean, in other words, does she have to have a CD in it to be running?
Yes.
Okay.
The software comes on a CD. I mean, it's an interactive CD.
Yeah, that, so it'll stay in the hard drive, the CD
yes,
drive,
exactly.
while she's using it. Okay. The reason
right.
I mention that is some of the ultra light laptops don't have CD uh-huh. drives in them. So that would be a slight disadvantage. The ones I'm liking a lot now, they're very lightweight. They're very inexpensive. Are the you like that? I can tell.
Yeah.
I don't blame you. Are the Lenovo's? The Lenovo took over IBM's ThinkPad business. The IBM
right.
ThinkPads were always very, very nice and very robust and reliable. They have, for instance, the C series ThinkPads. These are the old ThinkPads. Starts at $599, and
brand new.
Brand new. Now, you're not getting the super fastest processor in the world. Actually, it's a pretty fast. Actually, she didn't even say that because it's a pretty fast processor. You know, you make a few uh-huh. compromises, but it's not the dual core processor. But you don't need that. She doesn't need anything really elaborate.
Yeah.
So I would take a look at the Lenovo's. I think those are okay. very good. They have very lightweight ThinkPads. They will do everything you want. The prices are right.
Okay.
You know, again, just pay attention because the extra light ones,
yes.
like the 2 pounders and the 3 pounders, don't have often CD drives in them. So I make sure that they have a built-in CD drive so that she can play that. But
okay.
You know, now the thinnest and lightest ones are more expensive. Ironically, you pay more to get less. So if you really want something like down at the 3 pound level, you'll be paying
yeah.
around $1,400 for that.
Okay.
But, you know, so, I mean, it's 5.8 pounds for the $600 one. So, it's not.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's not a huge difference. So, I like Lenovo. I think they're very robust. They actually were the first company to put a technology in that protects the hard drive if it gets dropped. Many of these have it now. But I think that this will be a good choice for her. Now, as far as she can't use one hand...
Right.
Is she going to be able to type and mouse and everything with the other hand?
No, she'll use just her left hand to do everything.
Okay.
But
you might want to look at, and there may be in the hospital or the rehab center, there may be, and probably will be in a rehab center, an expert on computing, accessibility. You may ask them what would be the best kind of pointing device. It might be that the trackpad on the laptop is not ideal, that she will need, for instance, a trackball, which is something that can be done very, very easy to move the mouse with just small movements of the fingertip. And that might be more appropriate. That would be something to ask the people in the rehab center. What is it?
Okay.
What mobility issues does she have with that left hand? What will make it easiest for her? Is she a righty?
I'm sorry?
Is she a right-handed person?
No, yes, she was.
Yeah.
Yes, she is right-handed.
So it might be a little tough for her to do the fine motor control. So if in that case, you might want something with a bigger trackball. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So that's something. Right. But those are inexpensive add-ons that any laptop can accommodate.
Oh, okay.
But so it's just something to be aware of. The most laptops now have these trackpads, which may be perfect for her. It may be exactly what she needs.
Okay.
But it may not be, and if it's not, then you can easily add a different
playing
device. Sure.
I'm sorry. Would you say that looking into a refurbished?
Certainly. If you go somewhere like Dell that has mm-hmm. a very good refurbished selection. If you're going to a reliable company, refurbished is not a bad thing. What it is often a brand new laptop that can't be sold as new because it was taken home and opened. If somebody has buyer's remorse or decide not to keep it or it doesn't work for mm-hmm. them and they return it, even though it's in perfectly good shape, mm-hmm. it can't be sold as new. So if you go to a reliable vendor, a reputable vendor like Dell,
okay,
when you get a refurbished one from them, it's basically new. It's just that they sent it to somebody and the person decided not to keep it. And so the full warranty and everything. So and Dell also makes very lightweight, very good notebook systems.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
I have no hesitation recommending them as well. And a company like Dell, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't have an accessibility expert.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I would call them and say, hey, do you have somebody who knows about accessibility and can help me choose a computer for a particular situation, and they might have some good suggestions for you as well.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that very much.
Oh, you're welcome, Marie. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. Yeah, I mean, a computer is a wonderful thing for people who have disabilities of many kinds. Sometimes you have to tune it a little bit, but they're really great. I forgot to mention, we'll talk about it when we come back. I was going to talk more about Jim's issue, the bug that he caught, because there are some things to be said about that, and I neglected to do that. I will do that when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, KFI, AM 640, more stimulating talk radio.
Stimulate yourself all weekend long. KFI, AM 640. More stimulating weekends.
KFI, AM 640. More stimulating talk radio. Leo Laporte, the tech guy on KFI. So Jim in San Pedro said he was out and about at a hotel, let his firewall down, and caught a bug. Got home, had the SDBot, which is a pretty bad Trojan horse virus on his system. It's one that allows a hacker access to a system. It puts a system on a botnet. So what that means is it puts chat software — all of this is invisible to the user, by the way — puts chat software on the computer, logs into a chat room, again, without your knowledge, and awaits commands from the hacker. The hacker uses the chat room as a way to access his botnet. Usually these botnets are used for one of two things: either to send out spam, or to be massed together to attack another system, to do a massive denial of service attack on another system. They become part of a botnet army. Now, he says once he had this SD bot on his system, he found many other viruses there as well. That's not uncommon. Essentially, the hacker has full control of your system, could do anything he wants, including putting other viruses on there. Now, he says his antivirus says it's clean. He's tried three different antiviruses. They all say it's clean. And yet, he'll leave the room and come back in. His computer is furiously busy. And there's a couple of programs running, msgs.exe and ccap.exe. Now, these are both ostensibly, nominally harmless programs. The Windows Messenger and actually CCAP is part of Symantec Antivirus, Norton Antivirus. But of course, if you're a virus author, what are you going to name your virus? What are you going to name that process? You're going to name a system, a normal, safe system process name, right? So that nobody will know it's a virus. You're not going to call it evilvirus.exe. So the name of a program running really is meaningless. What's more significant is that, unfortunately, thanks to things like rootkits, it's possible for a hacker to put something on your system that is indetectable. Now, there are programs like Rootkit Revealer from SysInternals you can run on your system and try to ferret it out. But security experts are very clear on this. Once a system has been compromised, once a system is demonstrably compromised, as yours has been, Jim, it is impossible to assure yourself technically that there is nothing left on that system, that it is not still compromised. There is no good way to assure yourself of that, short of formatting the hard drive and reinstalling Windows. So if strange things keep happening after you got rid of the viruses, I think that's cause enough to reformat and reinstall. I really do. There are, of course, you can run Rootkit Revealer and you can continue to try to track down the problem and, you know, run many antiviruses and hope you've gotten rid of it. But honestly, at this point, the chance is still high enough that you could have an indetectable infection that it's really worth formatting and reinstalling. It's the only way you can be sure you're safe. Now, how does he protect himself in future? Well, the same way you protect yourself all the time. You make sure you always install all the critical patches from Microsoft, that you run anti-spyware and antivirus software, that you behave yourself online. You don't open attachments. You don't say yes to new applications from websites you don't know. You're careful about clicking on links in email and instant messenger. And I think if you're in a wide open environment like a hotel, it's probably a good idea to run VPN software. I use HotspotVPN.com, $8.88 a month. And the reason I recommend that is what probably happened, what I think is likely that it happened, is that he was compromised by a hacker who actually watched him type in passwords and so forth, and really has access to his system in deep ways that he doesn't know about. So you can have all the protection in the world, but if you're running in the clear with your passwords, your email, and everything out there, that's pretty risky. So I think in future, of course, keep your firewall on when you're out there. You know, behave well, but also run a VPN. I always run a VPN when I'm on out in a hotel and so forth. Hotel networks are notoriously insecure. And $8.88 for Hotspot VPN. There are other solutions that are free, but that's an easy one to run. Now, I want to get Marguerite on the line because she says my system, my website crashed her system. Margarita, welcome to KFI. Did I crash your system? Is she there? Did we lose her? I guess we lost her.
No, I don't have anybody name that.
Oh, I see it on the screen. I guess she's gone. Well, let me give you the details briefly. She says she clicked on an iTunes link on the show notes, leo.am. Yeah, there is an iTunes link. Now, that will launch iTunes if you click on that. What that does is it takes you to the iTunes page with all my podcasts on it. If iTunes crashed, that could be the problem. But my website is very vanilla, intentionally so, to protect you. But a system can crash anytime. I'm afraid that's the case. So, Margarita, I'm grateful that you're trying to listen to my podcasts. I apologize, but you know, it's not the website. It could be that launching iTunes crashed the system. But there's no software running on the website that would then run on your system. It's just plain old HTML. Okay. And I do invite you to visit the website, leo.am, or if you want to see more about my podcasts, twit.tv. This Week in Tech is the podcast, the weekly podcast, the big one, TWIT, and the website is twit.tv. My books are in the bookstores, Leo Laporte's 2006 Technology Almanac, 2006 Gadget Guide, The Guide to TiVo, The Guide to OS X Tiger. I hope you'll take a look at those, pick some up, give them as gifts. Mothers love technology books, I find. Don't you think? Well, I think so. And I hope I'll see you back here 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. every Saturday and Sunday to talk high tech. Dr. Dean Adell is coming up next. I'll see you next weekend. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, on KFI AM 640, more stimulating talk radio. At 1:59, Jessica Rosenthal's in the KFI News Center.
May 14th, 2006.
Well, that's it for this edition of The Tech Guy on KFI. Thanks so much for listening. If you're ever in the Southern California area, I hope you'll listen live on the radio every Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on KFI AM 640. You can also listen on the internet anytime at KFIAM640.com. Archives of older shows are available online on my website. That's leo.am. Click the audio archives button. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast, which is leo.am/podcasts/KFI. My thanks to Howard Bailey for providing the theme music for this show. You can listen to Howard's music at soundclick.com. Thanks to DSL Extreme for providing the bandwidth. Of course, first of all, thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time on KFI.